I'm delighted now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Diana Taylor. She is a 5-time Emmy Award-winning cinematographer and director of photography. She has earned Peabody Awards, a Muse Lifetime Achievement Award for Outstanding Vision and Achievement in Cinematography from New York Women in Film and Television. And she has a new film. She's writer, producer, and director of the film Grab a Hunk of Lightning, Dorothea Lange. The film is screening at the CCA, the Center for Contemporary Arts, here in Santa Fe, this coming Sunday, the 1st of February, at 2 in the afternoon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be back.
It's great to have you back. And this film is so interesting and so good. Dorothea Lange was not only a very famous photographer known for, among other things, her Depression images from the Dust Bowl and from other parts of the Depression and migration. And there's a very famous picture of a migrant mother kind of looking off into the distance, which was a, I guess you would say, really life and society changing photograph. She was also your grandmother.
She was also my grandmother, yes. A challenging grandmother, too. Not a warm and fuzzy grandmother.
No, and that is one of the themes of the film, is what happens when you have a woman artist who is that powerful and driven and talented, and there's this sense of the work is even bigger than she is, and it needs to be done no matter what else is going on.
Which is true, and she had a camera around her neck all the time, and whether she was photographing us or whether she was out on assignment, that was her life. And also considering her work, the film centers around her 1966 show at the Museum of Modern Art. She was the first woman to have a career retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, a photographer, first woman photographer, I should say. And that show, she actually didn't live to see. But the film centers around the preparation for that show and the work, a lifetime of work, and the very thing that you're talking about, this compelling necessity to photograph, comes out in this period of time where she's preparing this show for MoMA.
And luckily, there's all this footage left over from that time where they were filming her getting ready for the show. Who did that? Was that part of the museum show?
It was not part of the museum show. A teaching assistant of hers, because she had taught for a year, just found her so fascinating, he decided he wanted to make a film about her. His name is Phil Green. He's still alive, and he started shooting her, and for 3 years he would come and go from the house and film her, this extraordinary black and white footage. They did make 2 short black and white films for KQED about Lange. They're very sort of stylized, but the rest of the material was just extraordinary and beautifully shot, and it's like returning to the world of black and white, which was her world as well.
Right. Now, let's talk a little bit about her life. She was born in 1895, lived to 1965, and unlike many talented women of her time, she also had that kind of burning necessity to become a photographer, no matter what her mother or anybody else said.
Exactly.
And against all odds, and just basically moved to San Francisco, and that's what she did.
Right. She moved to San Francisco and was pickpocketed
right
when she got there. The travel across the United States, she grew up in Hoboken and New York, travels across the United States, is pickpocketed, and is forced to go to work at a photo finishing counter where she meets many interesting photographers, including Imogen Cunningham, the photographer, the great Bay Area photographer. And I should say right now that Imogen Cunningham's granddaughter, Elizabeth Partridge, will also be at the screening on the 1st.
Nice.
She's coming to speak. She wrote the companion book for this film and has an extraordinary and interesting, different take on Lange. So the two of us, and of course on her grandmother Imogen, so we'll both be there on the 1st, which is great.
Very interesting. How did Dorothea Lange develop her style and develop her kind of social conscience that led to all of these images of the poorest and most neglected people in the United States?
What people don't realize, and I guess I'm going to jump back a little bit, is that she had an enormous career, which far surpasses what we all think of as the Dust Bowl photography, the Depression era photography. She started as a portrait photographer, a very stylized portrait photographer, and did that work. And that portrait photography, I think, stood her in good stead when she found herself out in the field photographing real people in real situations. She never designed her photographs, though. She never posed her photographs. I'm sure she did when she was doing her portrait photography, but she never did once she moved into the documentary realm. She was married to the amazing painter, Maynard Dixon, and they had a very romantic and early life together. They photographed in the Southwest, so there's also a period of her photographing in the Pueblos and in Hopi land, in fact. And then she met my grandfather, Paul Taylor, who really began to help her focus her work and gave her opportunities. He was a social economist. He was out in the field. And he got her hired, actually, for the Farm Security Administration. And the two of them had the most extraordinary creative collaboration of any couple I can even, you know, even that I can even imagine.
And it was so interesting because he saw that images can tell stories that all the economic reports in the world can't
tell. Exactly.
And he was doing his own photographs, and then as soon as he saw her work, he said, I'm not doing this because she's so good at it.
Right. In fact, he hired her. He had to hire her as a so-called, quote, typist.
Right.
because there was no such thing as having a photographer accompany you on your work. But he absolutely saw the importance of words and photography working together. He was a very unique economist. He really felt that the work in the field was much more important than shuffling around statistics back in an office. And he was a visionary in his own right.
And so the two of them had this very creative collaboration. And meanwhile, she was really both an artist and a documentarist. And, I mean, the film, it's so powerful on so many levels because one of the things it does is that it makes you reflect on what an artistic life is like. And the personality of this woman, Dorothea Lange, I mean, she was so powerful and at the same time so humble. There's this part at the end where she's talking about how she's just beginning to become an artist at the age of 70. And you think, beginning to become an artist? Like, every single image I've seen in this entire film is, like, fabulous.
You know, she never considered herself anything but a craftsman. And she always used, the gender issues were very, very interesting, but she called herself a craftsman.
Yeah.
And you're right. I mean, it wasn't until the end of her life that she could actually begin to feel into being an artist. And the film contains a lot of journal entries of hers, very personal journal entries of hers, which begin to reflect on this life of photography. And she had two children of her own and then three additional stepchildren when she married my grandfather. So she was raising five kids, actually six, because of Maynard's first child, which was also her stepdaughter. So she had a very complicated situation on her hands in terms of both parenting and continuing with this very compelling career.
And as you point out in the film, if a man devotes his life to his art, nobody says anything. If a woman devotes her life to her art, there's all kinds of pushback on how she's a bad mother and so on.
Yeah. And you know, there are tender family issues around this.
Yeah.
And there were repercussions all the way through all of our lives because of her decisions. On the other hand, the work is extraordinary, and people also will see work that they can't imagine, which went on after that, her work in the environmental movement, and then work in foreign countries. She did a lot of work that, and also the very important work on the Japanese internment.
Yes.
Where she was, actually her work was impounded. It's a very interesting part of the story, that the government discovers that she's a pretty radical photographer and is actually showing what they don't want her to show, and so they impound her photographs.
And yet, they're in the movie, so at some point they were released?
Yes,
how did that work?
Released. They were gradually sort of quietly put into the National Archives, and they weren't discovered until recently that they were actually there, that people began to pay attention and realize that they were there.
Oh, yeah. My goodness.
So they've just been recently exhumed, if you will.
It's funny because, I mean, that story, you know, they hired her because, oh, she's a photographer who's done a lot of government work and has a reputation as a hard worker.
Right.
They had no idea that this photographer's attitude and conscience and love of people and sensitivity to their suffering and their emotions would so color the photographs that they had to be censored.
And she and my grandfather had personal friends who were Japanese, and they watched them lose everything during that period, which was such a horrible part of our history.
Now, as you said, she was also one of the early environmental photographers, and there's this absolutely heartbreaking sequence about a valley that was a very fertile farming valley in California that was filled in to make a reservoir dam, and reservoir for a dam, and the demise of the communities, the people, the farmland, is just, it's sort of shocking.
Shocking. It was one of the greatest sacrifices California made.
Yeah.
To ask the families who had been there for generations and generations to leave. They didn't ask. They told them they had to leave. And to sacrifice this incredibly verdant, beautiful valley and a way of life for a reservoir.
Yeah.
And Dorothea, instead of photographing sort of the power of the building of the dam and all of that, chose to photograph the last year in the life of that valley.
Yeah.
And she and, you know, she was, this was all happening right around the time Rachel Carson was coming out with Silent Spring. And so this was all very connected to a particular time in the late 50s where people
right.
were beginning to realize what they were doing to our wonderful environment.
We're talking to filmmaker Diana Taylor about the film Grab a Hunk of Lightning, Dorothea Lange. And one of the things that's really interesting to me and really cool is that, I mean, there's a lot of famous photographs by Dorothea Lange, but in this film, we see other photographs from the same shoot. So there'll be, whatever, 10 or 15 or 20 pictures that she took at that same time, and then one of them kind of makes the cut. But we see them all, and one of the things that kind of surprised me was how kind of friendly and hopeful some of these pictures are, even of people who had lost everything in the Dust Bowl and were migrating to the West. A lot of smiles, a lot of kind of that American moving West hopefulness and optimism.
Mm-hmm. Part of that was that she was capturing this optimism of moving, the migration moving west, and California was filling up with people full of hope that they were in the Golden State now and that their lives were going to change after a lot of suffering. But one of her gifts, which is why I think we were able to see some of this optimism, is that she herself was able to be with these people in a very natural way, that she
yeah.
wasn't entering their lives as some outside force, that she would come and be with them. She had polio as a young woman, which also people don't know, and so she had quite a visible limp, and she was a tiny woman, and she was willing to talk to people about their lives, ask them questions about their children. She was also willing to talk about her own children and her own lives and her polio. And so by the time she'd finished doing that, people felt quite at home with her. And also at the time, people felt she would say to them, you know, I'm from the government. I'm from the government. And people responded to that. They actually thought at that those times, which is hard for us to imagine now, that the government was bringing good things to their
You're
lives.
Right. You know? I'm from the government, and I'm here to help you.
Yes, right.
One thing that I was thinking about as I was watching this film is, I mean, those images went to Washington, and then they were published in all sorts of magazines and eventually books, and they were in Life magazine, which
right.
was new at the time, and Look
yeah.
magazine. And images were so powerful then in a way that, I mean, it sort of made me wonder, like, what is the power of images now in such an overly image-saturated society?
I've often thought, what would she think about this time?
Yeah.
I think she would, I think on the one hand, she would love the democracy of the fact that everyone can take an image or capture an image, that our lives are captured as images all the time now by a million different devices. I think she would find the reportage from that very democratic and marvelous. But I think she'd also be very distressed that, for her, the camera was a tool in terms of learning how to see. Even if you didn't photograph, it was a way in which you framed the world. And for me, as a child, I learned that very early on, that she challenged me to see what it was that I was looking at, whether it was stones in my palm or a wave, the curve of a wave or a friend's face. She always was demanding that we look twice and know what it was we were seeing. And so I think she would also find, despite the fact she would love the democracy of today's photography, I think she would also find it distressing in that people really aren't seeing.
It is interesting And that's one of the things that's beautiful about this film, too, is that it's so personal, because here you are, the granddaughter, making the film, and you went in, into that line of work. You became a cinematographer. Mm-hmm. And there's this moment early on in the film where I guess you pick up some pebbles on the beach or something, and she says, you know, did you see them? And mm-hmm. she says, did you really see them? Yeah. And that changed everything.
Yeah, it changed everything for me. It really did. And she did that to many of the grandchildren, and also to my aunts. But for me, it was the transformative moment where I looked back at my palm when she demanded that I see them, that I really see them. And I understood that there was something much deeper for us to understand about how we use our vision and how we interpret what we see. And it did. It changed my life.
One of the other things that I thought was really interesting in the film is that she understood not only the power of images, but the power of words. And so there were a lot of times when people whom she took portraits of were speaking, and she immediately wrote down what they said, and that became the caption for the photograph, and completed the photograph.
Completed the photograph, and she was incredibly true to those words. She would write down verbatim in exactly the language that they used, those words. And there's a wonderful moment in the film where she's reading some of those quotes with my grandfather. The two of them are reading them together. And for them, that was the essence of things. She was actually a fine writer, and people don't know that about her either. And her daybooks and her daybooks, her journals, her letters, and her study books, which she did all through, her caption books, which she did all the way through her career, are really unmined as a great body of work and should be studied.
So how do you feel that she has influenced your work throughout your life? I mean, you lost her when you were still a school child.
Yeah, I lost her in my early teens. But I'd spent a lot of time with her. Of course, I'd witnessed her photographing every time I was with her, which was a lot. she was always photographing. I took it quite for granted, photography. And I was also around her photographs. So all the drawers, you could pull out a million drawers and they'd all have photographs. They were coming out of every aperture of the house, you know, every place you could see, there were photographs everywhere.
Yeah.
So it influenced me deeply in terms of a formal way of seeing. I think that I'm more of a formalist than a wildly, experimental filmmaker, that I have a classical eye, and I still appreciate that. But it also, I was, of course, influenced greatly to go into the social documentary world and social needs, environmental. The environmental push is a really big thing for me.
There's also something that she says, and which comes up throughout the film in different ways and in subtle ways, which is something along the lines of, I didn't write down the quote exactly, if I were her I would have, but something along the lines of, you can see the beauty around you when you feel deeply, when you go to that deep place within yourself.
Yes. Yes, that's a wonderful quote. It's in the early part of the film, and for her, she was such a sensitive soul. She was a very solitudinous young woman, as a young woman. And I think that formed, her father left the family when she was very young, I think, and her polio. I think there was something very deep chords that were struck in her, and that she was someone who used seeing and that expression to understand that part in herself, which had been unformed for a long time. I'm not doing a good job of that, but she was extremely sensitive. And yet, ironically, so devoted to her, to that part of her life, that she sometimes forsake the family.
Well, and not only that, I mean, she was very, very sensitive, and she could go into parts of the world that were so kind of scary, dangerous, poor, down and out, and carry with her that sensitivity. And somehow, I imagine, a kind of sense of safety, because she knew that what she was doing had so much heart.
Yeah, talking about how she approached people, certainly in this country, but when she traveled in the foreign lands, it was different for her. And because she didn't have language, she didn't have control over her time. She still had her limp. She was older. She was ill when she traveled in foreign countries. She did a lot of traveling when she was very, very ill. She was willing to travel, actually, in a very, very advanced part of her cancer.
Amazing.
Yeah, it was, and she was skin and bones, and holding her clothes up with safety pins, and still photographing, but I think that the camera was always her way of separating her from any danger, and yet I think she had great confidence in her presence of whoever her subjects were. She said there were very few times where she actually felt afraid.
We're talking to filmmaker Diana Taylor about the film Grab a Hunk of Lightning, Dorothea Lange. And as you said when we started, the film is kind of framed around the preparation of a retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art, and it's really striking how she, even when in the throes of esophageal cancer, which is very painful and serious, was able to, and actually kind of came alive, working with the curators and other people in preparing for this retrospective.
Yeah. This was the first woman photographer career retrospective ever launched at MoMA. And she understood its importance, and at the same time had some resistance of going back through her body of work and really looking at it. But the film allows us to see the process of her doing that. And as she goes through the body of work, we see her coming to terms with her own sense of self as an artist as opposed to just a craftsman, as she called herself. And that's a really interesting transition from her notion of herself as a technician or a photographer into being an artist. She was very, very sick at the time, very, very sick, and had enormous will. And the filmmaker, Phil Green, who shot a lot of that footage, really captures the will in her face. And you also see her working with her own photographs and how she pairs them and the importance of pairing images and not just having the solo image, but how you might juxtapose imagery together, which is an incredibly interesting creative process, and it was for her.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I thought was really striking, because that's something that curators do when they're designing an exhibition, what to put next to each other, which pieces of work speak to each other. Mm-hmm. And when the artist does that herself, that makes it even more powerful. And there's one very striking example of, I don't know what East Asian country she was in, but a very old face next to a very young face. And the images complete each other in this amazing way.
Yeah. You know, Mary Charlotte, there's an interesting part of the film that I ultimately took out, which I hated doing, but I had to because of the film's length and because it was another story unto itself, which was Dorothea's involvement with the book The Family of Man and the photo exhibition The Family of Man. And she worked very, very closely with Edward Steichen, who was the curator at MoMA at the time. And her participation in that was that she had more photographs actually in that book than any other photographer, but she also helped organize all the West Coast photographers for Steichen. And the two of them worked very, very closely together, and the footage is so great. It's one of the DVD extras on the DVD, that their interaction, which is very interesting. But she was so sick at the time when she was helping him as well that she had a collapse in her hotel room, nearly bled out, was discovered by Steichen's assistant, the great photographer, also Wayne Miller. And Steichen and Miller got her to a hospital and saved her life in the middle of the process of creating that exhibition in New York. So she was fighting a lot of physical ailments, including late polio syndrome, which is a syndrome that seems to return to people who have been polio victims. So she was also struggling with that, a lot of pain, a lot of exhaustion, and she could only eat Gerber's baby food and tiny bits of cracker and coffee ice cream, which was her favorite thing.
Oh,
but she literally lived on that the last few years of her life. It was very, very difficult. So we're in the film, we're seeing the process of her going through her life's work and at the same time slowly dying, and it's a very compelling juxtaposition.
We're talking to Diana Taylor, filmmaker, producer, writer of the film Grab a Hunk of Lightning, Dorothea Lange, which, by the way, is screening this Sunday, the 1st of February, at the CCA here in Santa Fe, and we'll talk about that a little later in the program. How did you come to make this film? I mean, you're Dorothea Lange's granddaughter, but how did this actual film come into being?
Because I've been a cinematographer and a documentarian for so many years, I started when I was 19. And not many women were doing cinematography in the way that I was doing it so many years ago. But her influence on me was enormous, and I every year would revisit this idea, oh, I should make a film about my grandmother. I should make a film about Dorothea and what, you know, why she did this and why I was so influenced by her. But I was not ready to do it. My sense of my own maturity, my own understanding of life as a documentarian, I just wasn't ready. And I also had to overcome my own 12 and 13, 14-year-old memories of Dorothea, that those lived so strongly in me that potentially I would be making a film that wouldn't do her justice and or me justice. It was very confusing for me. So I had to work with my own childhood memory and bring it up to my adult self and then re-look at her life through the lens of scholars, but also through all my family members to really begin to see who she was as an adult. And of course, when I knew her, she was very, very ill. So I knew her as a very ill grandmother and someone who was incredibly charismatic, incredibly compelling, challenging to be around. You wanted her light to shine on you, and you wanted to be in her presence all the time. But it was also a terrifying place to stand to be that close to her, because she could be very, very short with a grandchild, or especially me. I was kind of a wild granddaughter.
Really? I sort of imagined watching the film that she adored you and doted on you.
She didn't adore and dote on me. I mean, I was with her a lot. I'm sure she loved me, but she was very, very, she wanted to bring out the best in me, and she was always demanding excellence. And so to be around her, she didn't have a lot of time for frivolity or fooling around or playfulness even. There was a lot of laughter. It was her own great intellect, but that I wasn't up to that at 12, 13, 14. So for me, she was just always demanding that I do my best. She made me study, for instance. Of course, she made me practice my flute every day whenever I was with her. But when we would be together, she would also force me to study geometry at a very early age. She had these early geometry books for young people, and I was studying geometry, for instance. She would ask me to look through photo books and reflect on them. She would hand photos to me and say, "What does this mean to you?" She would do things like that. And so it wasn't like, oh, let's go play, or let's go cook in the kitchen, or let's go crochet. It was really, let's use your mind. What are you doing? And of course, all I wanted to do was sort of get away from all that. But it influenced me enormously, and it was actually good for me.
It's very interesting, because the life that you have had as not only her granddaughter, but as part of a kind of large and complicated family, really, and this isn't so much in the film, but I think it's important and interesting to talk about, leads one to reflect on, you know, I mean, she didn't give you the nurturing that one might expect from a grandmother, but the end result was really good for you, because you were a woman cinematographer way before most women even could possibly think of making that choice.
Yeah, that's true. I guess I wasn't inhibited, and I was pretty fearless about starting my career at 19. I shot my first film at 19. And I think that's because I always saw a camera in her hands. And although technology had already begun to change and I was learning cinematography and not still photography, in fact, I was handed her camera at a very early age. When she died, I inherited one of her cameras. And I think the idea was that I was going to carry on as a still photographer. My grandfather really, I think, hoped for that. And I was the eldest granddaughter, and I think he really wanted me to carry on her career. But the fact was that trying to become a profound photographer after having been exposed to her work was so excruciatingly painful that by the time I was 18, I stopped photographing altogether, 19, photographed altogether, and I didn't pick up a still camera until I was 35. But being a cinematographer was a safer way for me to express myself in the same world, but with images that moved, with images that were often in color and not just in black and white. And so I could express myself in a fresh way and not be compared to Lang. And in fact, I never told anyone for my first 15 years in my career that I was related to her, ever.
Very interesting, even though it probably could have opened some doors for you.
It could have opened doors, but I didn't want to be compared to her, and I didn't want to have to live up to that expectation, which I'd already set on to myself. I had set myself a huge expectation to be as brilliant as she was, and of course it was impossible. I wasn't formed enough. It was really pretty stressful when I look back on it.
Yeah. So there was a process, as you were saying, of kind of maturation and finding your kind of emotional relationship to your grandmother, to your family, to her work, that eventually did lead to your making this film. But even then, it was a long process of
long
making
process.
The film.
Yeah, it took me 11 years to make the film. Part of that, of course, is the struggle for documentarians to raise money. And it took me a long time to raise enough money to complete the film. But I started 11 years ago, and I kept chipping away at it, doing interviews, doing imagery. I did some very interesting sort of recreated imagery in dark rooms, things like that. So I was piling up the imagery, but I still couldn't financially finish the film, and I finally got a really substantial NEH grant from the National Endowment of the Humanities, which was a great honor, and that sort of propelled me into the final stages the last 2.5 years of making the film.
So what was it like? What was your process like? What did you draw on? Where did you start? How did it go forward?
You know, the film morphed. Every year it would morph again. It started with the notion of the muse and romance. It started with that my grandmother loved two men, and all three of them were cross-fertilizers for each other. Each of them influenced the other. Dorothea influenced Maynard Dixon, the great painter. He influenced her sense of framing and color, and also her way of living. And then the two of them influenced Paul Taylor to a degree, and when she met Paul Taylor, he became her muse, and he then influenced Maynard Dixon. Maynard Dixon began painting very interesting social issue, men on strike, the San Francisco waterfront strikes, you know, the forgotten man. He began to paint in that way. But there was deep love in that whole triangulation, and that's where I started. I started with that and the notion of the muse, which affects all of us. You know, we're all influenced by things in many ways. Dorothea was a muse for me, and the camera was a muse for me, and the camera was a muse for her. The camera was first a muse for her before the two men entered her life. And it's interesting, we don't think of an inanimate object, you know.
Being a muse,
but I indeed think it was.
What is the word muse, what does that concept mean to you?
It means both a moment of opening, and whatever the fragment, the moment, the breath that bleeds that to you is the muse, and that can be a person, it can be an image, it can be a moment in nature, it can be all those things. Most often we think of it as a man has a beautiful young woman and she's the muse, but I think the muse comes in many, many forms. It can be the universe, it could be a star, it could be all kinds of things. But I think in a consistent artistic way, for her, it was the influence of these two men and her influence on them. I mean, I think they were all growing, and so therefore, I think we all need to look at who is around us and who's influencing us, that we're not working in a vacuum, that we really are deeply indebted to those who both push on us, who make our lives difficult even, and who open us to new ideas, too.
I think the way art history is written and the way museum exhibitions are often about one person give rise to a kind of incorrect concept that some kind of lone creative person figures stuff out all by themselves. And it's, as you are talking about, it's really not the case. There's so much cross-pollination and so much conversation and influence and community really behind every great artist and work of art.
Yeah, there is. And I think that in Lang's case, we think of her, and I dispel this very much in the film, we think of her as the lone, brave photographer out there by herself with depressed people, you know, jostling among, you know, men or in the camps. And in fact, she was often had an assistant with her, and she was often traveling with my grandfather, who taught her a whole nother level of how do you look at this work and how do you interpret it. So from him came the notion of the caption and the idea of how do we document what the people are really feeling and saying, and then for her it was the visual, and the two of them worked together in a particular way that was very, very rich. So I don't think of her as working alone so much. He loved her fiercely, and until the moment she died, that love was so profound. And we also think of women. We also think of women as the muse object, as opposed to a woman who had muses. And definitely, my grandfather and Maynard Dixon and the camera were her muses.
It's interesting also when you talk about this essentially kind of love, artistic, creative triangle of the painter Maynard Dixon, the photographer Dorothea Lang, and the economist, and I guess you might call him a social activist, Paul Taylor, who was your grandfather. I mean, Paul Taylor and Dorothea Lang met. They both left their spouses.
Absolutely.
And how did the spouses, in particular Maynard Dixon, who was in his own right a great painter, respond to that? I mean, did he allow his heart to open to, you know, the influence of Paul Taylor, who was basically his rival, who stole his true love away?
It is very, very interesting because I think as their relationship developed, she was traveling with Paul Taylor before Maynard fully understood, I think, that they were falling in love with each other. But so Maynard was influenced by Paul Taylor, and even after they split up, Dorothea and Maynard split up, Maynard accompanied them on various trips and furnished beautiful painted maps for them, one of which is in the film, and they'd spent Christmas holidays together. It was very odd. However, Maynard was devastated by losing her. He was 20 years her senior, and I think he felt at that point that his life might be over, and I think he missed her seriousness. He was a very, very funny man, but a man who refused to get involved in social issues, and she was quite the opposite, extremely serious and got deeply involved in social issues, which is why I think Paul Taylor was the perfect fit for her.
There's a line in the movie where she is reflecting on Maynard Dixon, who, I mean, was really in his own right a first-rate painter, but she was saying that he hadn't gone deep enough, and she wished that she had encouraged him to dip his paintbrush in his own heart's blood.
It's an incredible quote, and that is exactly what she said, that she felt that he never would go deep enough and that he always shied away from the fullest expression of what he could really do and his fullest potential. And I think that's part of the reason they could no longer be together. Despite her feelings about my grandfather, I think the marriage might not have lasted. But here's what's interesting. The morning that Dorothea decided to tell my uncle Daniel, her eldest son, that they were getting a divorce, and Dan was, I don't know, 12 at the time or something. He came into their bedroom. Maynard and Dorothea were naked and in bed. They'd been in bed all morning, and Dorothea announced that they were getting a divorce to their son at that point. So that tells you how embedded these lives, so to speak, these lives were together in terms of creative participation, and there was a great deal of love there. And Maynard was an extraordinary painter, but again, didn't go deep enough for Dorothea.
So you made this film over the course of, what is it, about a decade?
Mm-hmm, yes.
And you were saying that it kind of morphed as mm-hmm. it went along. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
Well, as I say, it started as a love triangle, and I realized that it didn't have enough depth of its own in that way. And that as I began to learn more and uncover the stones, both from the family and from various scholars, I began to see Dorothea in a different light, and I realized that I had to include the deep scholarship about her life, and that I couldn't just make it a family tale, that wouldn't hold much for people. It would be interesting, and it would be juicy, but it wasn't really enough. And so I went back and did a great deal of research and a lot of just plowing through material, interviewing people, talking to people, so that I would gain some distance from my childhood memory and I could really approach her as an adult. And that was really what happened in the last few years. It was really important for me to do that. And because I'm narrating the film and the film somehow is from my point of view, I had to be very careful about how much I enter that domain as a voice in the film.
We're talking to filmmaker Diana Taylor about the film Grab a Hunk of Lightning, Dorothea Lange. And in any documentary, you know, those of us who are watching it assume or intuit that there's big pieces that are left out. And sometimes if you have the DVD, you can put extra features on it. But there's so much more on the proverbial cutting room floor that never gets in. But there's one very major theme that didn't get into the film, and I understand why, but I was wondering if you could talk about it a little bit, and that is the death of your own father when you were, at that same time, when you were still a young person.
So the film starts with a date, actually, very soon into the beginning of the film. It says September 64, and my father died suddenly at 39 in September of 64. And in the footage that I worked with, there was a lot of both audio and visuals of my grandfather and Dorothea in great grief and distress about losing my father, not to mention that my family was my brothers and my mother were devastated, and I was devastated. And I somehow could not fully address that in this film. The film would have become too personal, and it was too complicated to describe. But that loss is there in the footage. She's very, very ill, but underneath that is a grieving woman, and underneath my grandfather there, when you see him, is a grieving man who's just lost his son. And so for me, I had to revisit, by going through this footage, I had to revisit that as well as my young memories of Dorothea and my grandfather. I had to revisit this loss of my father. And then right after I got the National Endowment of the Humanities grant, in late 2011...
That allowed you to make this
film. My mother suddenly got ill with pancreatic cancer, and then she died. So not only am I revisiting the memory of my father's death and trying to understand how to deal with that, but I also was dealing, while I was actually cutting the film, with my mom's death. And, these moments in our lives, in creative lives and artistic lives, all lives occur, and it was, in my father's case, I couldn't quite deal with it, and yet I couldn't quite deal with putting that in the film. Of course, I don't talk about my mother in the film either, but it informed me as a human being as I looked at Dorothea's life and as I looked at Paul Taylor's life and as I looked at their lives together. I think it informed a great deal about how serious the film actually is.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, how do you feel like that gave the film the character that it has?
The main thing that I think it informed in the film, if we're just looking at the film, is the environmental section, which we've talked about earlier, which is the Death of a Valley section, which is about the loss of that incredible farm community and what those people endured, losing their homes and all their histories to that dam. And a way of life was lost, and some lives were lost, and that I approached that very differently. It didn't just become a quick chapter in the film. It really was something that I was willing to go deeply into, and I did.
So what is the life cycle of the film now? When did it come out? What's it doing? Where's it going?
The film was on American Masters, which was a wonderful place for it to be. It's going to be in a very wonderful strand of... It's one of 200 films so far that have been made by great filmmakers across the United States, and PBS's American Masters is a great strand for this film to be in. And so it was part of the American Masters strand. It was shown last year, in premiered in August. And the film is now having a semi-theatrical life. I'm speaking with it in at universities and museums, historical groups. The film is so flush with interesting chapters of our history, but also ideas about women in the arts and women in family, but also, and as I say, about our history, that many groups would be interested in seeing this film. So it's, I haven't sought theatrical distribution yet for the film. I haven't decided whether I will, but right now I'm being called upon to show it in many, many cases. I'll be showing it in Washington in March. I'm showing it in Louisiana, coming up in February. I have a lot of different ways in which the film is moving out in the world, and we have an educational component to the film, too.
There is a lot of, and we didn't really talk about this earlier, but I think it's important to watch the film and think about what poverty looked like then. Mm-hmm. And Dorothea Lange really gave a set of visuals to what poverty looked like in the first half of the 20th century. What does it look like now? How is it different? How is the same? How is it the same? How are these... people losing their land in the name of progress? How are people being exploited on the basis of their race? Or what does migration look like? I mean, it doesn't look exactly the same, but it's so many of the same themes that we have in this country today.
Well, that's what I would say. I mean, you've just said it yourself. The themes are the same. And in fact, they're just greater because the populations are greater. But the migrations are happening. People moving into refugee camps. People being expelled from their own countries. It's the same kind of depth of loss that's going on. There's a huge amount of poverty in this country that we still haven't addressed. The migrant worker is still struggling for rights. Yes, my grandfather was able to achieve better housing in California for some of the migrant workers. Yes, he was able to get fresh water in the fields for them, and some bathroom facilities, some sanitation facilities, but that they're still struggling for that. And I think that this film just reminds us of our own history and how we can do better, I think, and how we should continue to fight for these things. And the two of them were activists and gave themselves to the idea of the betterment of the human population.
One of the things that was so interesting to me is this iconic, super famous image of the migrant mother looking into the distance and her kids there. It turns out that this woman's name was Florence Thompson, and she lived a long life. She didn't even know that her image had become iconic. And in the film, it's just so weird. We see her when she's older wearing a very nice shirt and a nice necklace, and clearly she's done well, and you sort of don't expect that. Yeah.
Yes, we do see that. I mean, she attained middle class, and in her later years, she and her family found the photograph and realized that it had been used a lot and were very angry about its use and felt that they hadn't received any remuneration. But ultimately, it worked out fine that when she became very ill, you know, donations poured in to support her in her last years. And that she was actually, it's even more interesting, Mary Charlotte, and which people don't know and which I don't say in the film, is that she was Cherokee.
Is that right?
So think about that. If the American public, when they look at the image Migrant Mother, think that she is a Native American Cherokee woman, would they have given her the incredible due that she gets as one of the most important icons of the Depression? It's an incredibly interesting thought, and probably we would not have.
It would have been a completely different thing.
Right. So Dorothea didn't know she was Cherokee.
Right.
She only knew she was a single mother with all these children, and that's all she knew. And we do show the progression of those photographs. We show seven of the photographs that were taken that day, the only seven that were taken that day. So we're not just seeing the Migrant Mother herself, but that image that we also know so well, but we're seeing the progression of photos up to that point. And it's a very beautiful progression.
Very much so. And the different expressions on her face, because we think of her as sort of frozen in time as being, as that image representing her whole being. And of course,
it wasn't.
In a 20-minute sequence, she had a whole bunch of different ways of expressing herself.
Yeah.
Now, we're just about out of time, but this film is being shown at the CCA this coming Sunday at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Grab a Hunk of Lightning, Dorothea Lange. And it's a whole event. It's a fundraiser for the CCA. There's going to be refreshments, a question and answer, reception. DVDs will be there for sale. And I thought this might be an opportunity to talk just for a moment about the CCA, which is just a wonderful, long-standing institution in this city.
The CCA really is, its mission is to have a gathering place and a place that we can claim as ours in terms of the arts, both visual arts, cinema, performing arts, and as a campus that we can use, all of us. And we've really worked very hard at CCA to bring that about. If you go to the Munoz Waxman Gallery, there's sitting areas in the back now. There's a library there where you can go and sit. The new foyer in between the cinemas is a gathering place. We've been working on finally getting a food license so we can perhaps open a small, very modest little restaurant there. We're developing a sculpture park in the beautiful treed area that leads up to the James Turrell sculpture. We are working with the State Armory Board and the Department of Cultural Affairs and the Children's Museum to create sort of a master plan which will sort of cement the Armory campus as one of Santa Fe's key cultural destinations. And CCA has really come into its own. 35 years, here we are, we're still here to stay. I urge everyone to become a member, of course. It's not expensive to become a member, and it's really something we should all be supporting.
It's a wonderful institution, and we're looking forward to a wonderful event with not only filmmaker Diana Taylor, but also Elizabeth Partridge.
Imogen Cunningham's granddaughter.
Right.
Who's amazing in her own right, has done 3 books on Lang and other very interesting books, and she will also be speaking that day.
And as you've said, you and she have kind of different perspectives on the same person.
On the same person, yeah, which is really quite wonderful.
Yeah, well, very interesting conversation will, I'm sure, ensue. Diana Taylor, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.